Welcome to This Is Money Podcast. I'm Georgie Frost, and alongside me today is editor Simon Lambert. And this week, the true cost of the coronavirus pandemic was laid bare in the Chancellor's spending review. The numbers, well, they weren't pretty, but that wasn't a big surprise. But is now the time to go investment bargain hunting? Also today, Marcus, the darling of savers, has turned into something like the Christmas Grinch, cutting easy access rates again, just days after NS&I slashed accounts to as little as 0.01%. We ask if you should lock in a cheap holiday to potentially dodge higher prices next year, or would you be crazy to even think about it now? And is triple glazing worth it? Because we cover it all in this pod. Don't forget to stay up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app. But first, this week we had the Chancellor's spending review, setting out where the government intends to spend its cash or not on public services and telling us, well, how the economy is doing. And it's not that great. In sum, we spent a lot of money on coronavirus. We're planning to spend a fair whack more, but we do surprisingly have pots of cash spare to throw at infrastructure projects as well. Either way, the pandemic hasn't been good for the economy, ours, or indeed many other parts of the world. But Simon will elaborate on what was in the spending review and what it all means. But what does this mean for investors first? Let's start with something a little bit positive. In this environment, can you root out a bargain? Well, apparently, yes, you can. But where do you start? So, Simon, welcome. We'll get to the spending review shortly, but bargain hunting for investors. What do we even mean by that?
What we mean is looking for investments that don't look expensive, that look cheap. They don't have to be screamingly cheap. You don't have to be doing what was described famously as by the famous value investor Ben Graham as picking up pennies in front of a steamroller. You're going for stuff that, you know, looks like it's on death's door, and if you buy enough of those, then some of them won't fail, and when they don't fail, their price will rocket. It's looking for things that don't look heavily overvalued. In investing circles, this is a topic that's on a lot of people's minds at the moment, because the world's largest stock market, the US, looks pretty peaky. It bounced back very, very strongly from the coronavirus crash. It was already going great guns before the coronavirus crash. The S&P 500, the Dow Jones, the Nasdaq were up a lot and had been in a multi-year bull run. That's when basically prices just keep going up. The coronavirus crash came along, lockdown, people panicked, sold their shares, prices crashed. And then on the day roundabout that Britain went into lockdown, 23rd of March, was pretty much the day that markets around the world hit the bottom and then suddenly rebounded. And the US market has absolutely powered ahead since then. I mean, particularly the tech-focused NASDAQ index, but even the S&P 500 and the Dow Jones have really shot up. So there is a concern that things might have got slightly ahead of themselves, that maybe that largest stock market in the world, the one that leads the way, the one that if you put your money into a very simple global tracker fund invested in shares, you're going to end up with about 60% of your fund invested in the US stock market. There's concerns that that looks a little bit pricey. Now, there's cheap money flooding around that's been pumped into the system by central banks to help us. There's stimulus packages from governments. There's all these kinds of things going on. But you have to look at it and think, have markets got ahead of themselves? Are we riding for a fall? And one way of trying to avoid riding for a fall is to look for the stuff that hasn't absolutely rocketed up and so therefore has a little bit more headroom and a little bit further to go.
Okay, so then where should you be looking? I'm asking this because I'm wondering in terms of people's behavioural changes. When you think about where you're going to invest, you're thinking about the future, what might be popular, what won't be, what things have done badly now, maybe those things that will do well in the future. But I'm wondering how much of a fundamental shift do you think our behaviour has changed during this time? Or, and this is a lot of if, buts and maybes, and we'll get a lot of if, buts and maybes later on when we talk about whether we should book a flight abroad. But, you know, if we get the vaccines, if we have all this sort of thing, are some of the things that we've seen, the working from home, the buying online, are they likely to stick around and therefore that's where people should be looking in the future?
I think to an extent they are. I think that there has been a dramatic shift in behavior. If you look at various things, even companies in their corporate results, some of them are saying you've seen a 5 years worth of change in behavior in 6 months, the kind of thing that would normally take 5 years for people to change their patterns of behavior. However, the companies seem to be benefiting from that. The tech companies, the Amazon, Google, Microsoft, Zoom, you know, companies like that have seen a big bump in their share prices. And maybe you have to say, well, even if the world does change and it shifts to a more digital scenario that benefits those kind of companies, maybe that's already priced in to those companies. People have already rushed to buy those shares. Then you've seen an uplift in companies that have just benefited from the pandemic itself because people have done things slightly differently or bought more of a certain stuff. In the UK, two of our biggest retail names have done remarkably well. Halfords, the auto centre and bike seller, has done really, really well in terms of sales. Now, maybe it was just on the up anyway and it had improved its offering and it was going to do well. But there's definitely been, and it has said this in its results, there's definitely been a boom, down to lockdown. The other one, Kingfisher, which is the owner of B&Q. If you remember back to about the second week of lockdown, there was sort of some question as to whether DIY shops could open. And then B&Q announced that it was going to open for click and collect so that people could order stuff online and then go and collect it. And B&Q's website ended up with a massive queue to get into it. People were waiting hours just to get onto the B&Q website to order stuff. And then there was a bit of a sort of click and collect meltdown. People were driving to car parks and having to queue to get into the car park to then do a sort of secret handover of goods from B&Q. But B&Q says that sales uplift has continued. It's continued to do well. And it's people are stuck at home. They're like, well, we might as well fix this or fix that. And oh, I need a new drill if I'm going to do that. And, you know, so from materials through to tools and paint and everything like that, people have been going shopping for that kind of stuff. The question is, of course, with a company like B&Q, Kingfisher that owns B&Q, with a company like Halfords, pets at home, people have been spending loads more on their pets, for example. There's been a boom in pet sales. Is that going to continue? Are they going to be able to capitalize on that and have permanently shifted growth upwards? I'm not entirely sure whether that is the case. Now, it might be that some of those customers who've been there are going to become repeat customers, the loyal customer, at the risk of upsetting you by using the word loyal in line with customers.
See
podcast arguments past. Of course, some of those people will keep going back. They might go, oh, B&Q is much better than it used to be. Oh, I really like Pets at Home. Or, oh, yeah, I'm going to keep shopping at Halfords. But how much of that is going to continue? So if you're buying their shares, are you buying them because there's a momentum thing going on, as in they've gone up lots because they've been reporting good sales at the moment? Or are you buying them because you think Halfords is going to be an absolutely cracking investment for the next 5 years? To use another example of a company, one that I'm interested in personally, actually, because I like wine, and also because my sister-in-law is signed up to this and told me about it. She's quite pleased with it. It's Naked Wines, yeah. Right? So, and I was interested enough to actually have signed up for it and then bought a small amount of shares myself because I think it could do quite well. Now, Naked Wines was spun out of was merged some years back with Majestic. And then it was spun back out of it. The business is separated recently. And Naked Wines has seen a big uplift in sales and customers over the since lockdown. And what people do, it has what it calls angels. And they sign up, they buy some wine. Normally there's some kind of customer acquisition deal, like you get a big discount when you first buy a case of wine or whatever. You sign up to pay a certain amount in. The default amount is like £20 a month. That goes into your account. And you can then use that to buy wine. What's different about Naked Wines is it deals directly with the producer, with the wine grower. So it cuts out all the different layers in the middle that you normally have with buying wine. So theoretically, you're getting better quality wine at a cheaper price, and you are directly supporting the wine grower And the vineyards and things like that. And so, and it encourages, you know, the wine grower to do different things. So it's quite a nice idea. I quite like it. Now, where that comes from is Naked Wine's share price has gone up loads because it's acquired a ton of customers this year. And it said that, it said something like there's been a 5-year shift in 6 months of what it's seen. And one of the places where it's acquired lots of customers is the US, where it was obviously trying to sort of make a dent in the US, and it's seen a big sudden uplift over there. So could that continue? Now, arguably, I'd say compare that to a Halfords or a Pets at Home or you know, Kingfisher B&Q. There's more chance of that being a shift that continues and that they can capitalize on in years to come than more people going down to Halfords. Now, there's every chance that I'm wrong, okay? So that's not a recommendation to buy. This is not me talking my own book, and I have declared my own vested interest here. But there is every chance that I'm wrong. Now, but the thing is the Naked Wines that doesn't even make a profit. Okay, it actually makes a loss each year. The figures are improving, but it makes a loss each year. So that is fundamentally an expensive investment because it doesn't even have a price to earnings ratio, and you know the share price to the earnings, because there isn't any profits to measure that on. So the opposite is going looking for the bargains.
I think in terms of your behavioural shift, you're right. I think we were reading this week, weren't we, that the tax receipts from alcohol have gone up despite the fact that pubs have been shut, which means that we are enjoying a beverage or two in our homes. And I think people will realise that that's probably something that they will do more often, I think, to the shame of pubs, really. But, you know, these are difficult times for pubs. There may not be as many around after this. However, it's that old supermarket argument again, isn't it? Supermarkets selling the loss leading alcohol. If you're not really that bothered about your wine, then why not just get it on the cheap for £5 a bottle? I know, read This Is Money articles in the past about why you should spend £10 on a bottle. We don't have to go down there at the moment. But that is not a bargain. But that it shows that even things that are doing well that you think that might be doing well at the moment may not do well in the future. But there are risks either way. What should you be thinking about when you are bargain hunting particularly?
Okay, so the first one is don't put all your eggs in one basket.
Of course.
This is so blindingly obvious that I can imagine our regular podcast listeners going, oh, God, honestly, say something new. But really, like, don't, you know, this is classic. People get carried away and they put too much into one thing. So when that investment sinks, then they've got a problem. So if you want to go, there's been research done and you need roughly about 15 to 20 shares, different companies, if you're going to buy individual shares, in order to be sort of properly diversified. But they need to be companies that do different things and aren't all exposed to the same risk. So if you went out and bought 15 different tech companies, you can see the obvious problem there. Likewise, if you're going to be buying funds or investment trusts, obviously there's a fund manager there actively picking what they think are the best shares. And so they have diversified your risk in a way that you don't diversify your risk if you just buy individual shares, because they're likely to have at least 25 companies in that fund. Even the really, really tight funds and trusts run about 20, 25 companies minimum, and many have many, many more. But a fund or an investment trust is largely invested into one type of sector or company or looks for a certain style or things like that. And so watch out for just holding one if it does something specific. If it's a really, really general fund or trust, there are some that invest all around the world in shares, in bonds and all that kind of stuff. You can get away with just holding one. But if you are bargain hunting, by the nature of investment bargain hunting, you are taking a risk that you are wrong and that it's a bargain for a reason, and that that company is only going one way and that way is down. It's not doing a Yaz. The only way is not up. The only way is down. And there are many, 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 many examples of people buying companies that they think are bargains, shares that they think are bargains, and then it just keeps on tanking all the way to bust. So be careful on that one. The only other thing I'd say in terms of bargain hunting is, have you worked out whether it really is a bargain? If you're buying individual shares, you need to look at the numbers. Okay, you need to do proper research and you need to look at the numbers. If you're buying into a fund or a trust, or even a tracker, then you need to be doing a little bit of thinking about, like, what is the component parts of it and everything. But, you know, one man or woman's bargain is another man or woman's expensive thing, because actually they just think it might look cheap, but it's rubbish.
Yeah, indeed, indeed. Also in this article, I wanted to ask you, the speculation the FTSE could be on the brink of a major rally. I never thought I'd say this, but I appreciate that Brexit is rumbling on in the background, but it's sort of playing massively second fiddle to all this talk about coronavirus. How do we factor that into all of this?
Who'd have thought this time last year that Brexit would become the most downplayed thing in the national psyche? It's hilarious, isn't it, really? I mean, we were in the run-up to the election last year, weren't we, at this point? And God, that was awful, the run-up to that
election.
Times
have changed.
Yeah, indeed. But you know, Brexit was front and centre stage. You do need to take that into account. Now, the thing is the FTSE 100 is largely not that affected by Brexit. It's got a lot of big international companies in there that do business all around the world, and it doesn't make so much of a difference. What does make a difference, actually, is the pound, and whether the pound goes up or down. And if the pound goes down, it makes investments in the UK cheaper to overseas investors, and so makes them look like a little bit more of a bargain. If the pound goes up, it has the opposite effect. So often you see the FTSE and the pound moving opposite directions. There is an argument that the FTSE, be it the FTSE 100 or the FTSE All Share, as which is better representative of the whole of the UK stock market, is itself a bit of a bargain, because it's not gone up by anywhere near as much as many other stock markets after the coronavirus crash. And before the coronavirus crash, it hadn't gone up by nearly as much as many other markets. It's still down 16% this year, whereas if you look to America, the S&P is up something like 10% this year, which is astonishing, really, when you consider how bad the world looked for investors back in March. So yeah, maybe the FTSE or the All Share or the FTSE 100 is a bargain. We talked about the FTSE 100 in this article. It's a guy called Brian Dennehy, of Fund Expert, and he said, you know, could go up, could hit 9,400, but that's just a 50% rise. That's just it going up by 50%. Sounds crazy. But if you take that over a couple of years, say you take that over 3 years, that's 15% a year. From the point where it is now, if there's a sudden uplift, massive rise in sentiment, Brexit turns out to not be absolutely dreadful, in, you know, everyone just gets used to it kind of thing. Mm-hmm. It's not beyond the realms of possibility. You know, there are 3 year periods where stock markets do go up by an average of 15% a year. So that's actually the first one on our bargain list. We had something come through. Darius McDermott, Tanya spoke to him earlier this week, of Fund Caliber, which picks funds. So it's a fund picking place. She also spoke to Rob Morgan of Charles Stanley Direct, a man who has previously featured on the special podcast with us. And the UK came up as a potential bargain, for the reasons that I just said. So did Teodor Dilov of Interactive Investor, said the same thing. The next one, European smaller companies. The reason why these are considered a potential bargain is that there is a lot of opportunities there. Europe is a large place. You won't need me reminding you of that. If you look at its biggest companies, everyone knows all about them. But if you look at its smaller companies, they're quite under-researched. People don't know that much about them, and investors tend to just herd into the large European companies and maybe a little bit of the medium-sized companies, but the smaller ones get left a bit alone. Property, as in commercial property. It's like, commercial property. I mean, talk about the highway to the danger zone. People getting locked in funds. We've had people shut into property funds again this year because of the crash in prices. We've got less office demand. We've got less retail demand due to lockdown. I don't need to go into the obvious reasons for that. If you buy into it, use an investment trust. Don't use a fund where you run the risk of being shut in. It's not the greatest investment for a fund is not the greatest way to invest in actual physical properties. But that could be a bit of a bargain. Latin America, markets still look cheap, could benefit from the new US leadership, President Biden elect. I mean, unless Donald Trump turns out to be president again, which is a possibility. Basic resources. There's been a crash in sort of resource prices, commodity prices, due to the massive global slowdown. Japanese small caps. Now, here's one. Japan's stock market is a funny old place, and Japan has been desperately trying to boost its stock market. We've been absolutely clear in its ambition under the previous President Abe. He has now retired, and there's a new leader there. But the same thing is going on. They want to boost the stock market, and smaller companies are going to benefit from this kind of thing, especially as they're trying to improve corporate behavior and change business practices. Asia has navigated the pandemic better than the West, could retain that advantage. Technology, we'll go back to what we said at the start. How could technology be a bargain? I mean, you know, look at the companies and how they have gone to the stratosphere in some ways. But maybe people are underestimating the digital shift. Maybe people are underestimating how much some of these technology companies can capitalize. And also, interestingly, with some of them, people might be underestimating the amount of cash that these companies hold or the actual intrinsic value. I did an investing show interview with fund manager Stephen Yu of the Blue Whale Growth Fund a while back, maybe a month or so ago. And I asked him about this because it's a growth fund and invests in a lot of these US tech companies. But he describes himself as a value investor. And I said, how do you square those two things? And he said, well, you know, Facebook, for example, has got tons of cash. And I don't think people take that fully into account. And he said also, even if it did face sort of antitrust laws that forced it to kind of split up some of its businesses in the US, which some see as a big risk for some of these big tech companies, he said, I think that it's got assets that are underappreciated. So everyone knows, you know, Facebook and Instagram to a certain extent. Does it monetize Instagram as much as it could do? I think it's starting to, but maybe not as much as it does Facebook. But WhatsApp, it owns WhatsApp and it just doesn't even monetize that at all. And it's one of the world's biggest messaging platforms. So, you know, that he argues that Facebook actually does represent good value. I mean, I'm not saying I back that idea, but there is an argument there. I think you'd struggle to argue that Tesla is good value, but there are people who do argue that because you just don't understand Tesla. And it's totally different this time. It's going to change batteries and space travel and cars and everything in the world. Elon Musk is going to personally come around and improve your house.
But he's a genius though, isn't he? I mean, that's you know, there's that aura of Elon Musk. So anything he touches must...
On paper, he became the world's second richest man this week.
There you go. On paper. Mm, exactly. On paper. Yeah. I should say Midas touch, but we know what happened to Midas. It didn't end well for him. Anyway, I want to ask you about the spending review as well, given that it was sort of a big deal-ish, I think. I mean, I say ish only for the fact that I don't feel much the wiser after watching the speech. I didn't think it was a bad speech, don't get me wrong. I didn't think it was bad, given the environment we're in, and there's really not a lot you can do, and it was normally supposed to be 3 years review, but really you can only do 1 year, and really can you do 1 year? I mean, as I said in the intro, we've spent a lot of money, we're going to spend a lot more, we're going to spend even more on things like infrastructure, and the economy, the economic outlook, according to the OBR, grim, but again, we sort of knew that, didn't we? Brexit, that didn't really get a mention in there. So what was in there, Simon? What did we learn that we perhaps didn't know before? Where are we heading? How did Rishi do?
Rishi did well. Rishi always does well, doesn't he? Apart from when he's helping the self-employed, who he seems to have forgotten a very large number of whilst handing out money to anyone who moves. Rishi did well. I mean, it was very much a... man stands up and tells us about unbelievable sums of money speech that even if you're interested and know what he's talking about and it's your job to pay attention, which it is for some of us, it starts to go slightly over your head, really. It's just like more money, more money, more money, more debt, more spending. We'll stick it on the tab. And the tab's massive, by the way, guys. But, you know, don't worry about that. Interest rates are low. And, yeah, there's a lot of pain in years to come, but we won't raise taxes yet. We don't want you to completely freak out. I mean, that is basically the general gist of it. We are facing the steepest downturn since the Great Frost of 1709. The Great Frost of 1709 doesn't sound like it was very great. Yeah, a slump of 11.3% in GDP this year, which actually, really, when you think about it, considering what's happened, doesn't sound that bad. I mean, in economic terms, it's awful. But, you know, Rishi has been ready to spend to drag the country out of the crisis. And he said that that was the right thing to do. And that method has been, you know, it's been rubber stamped by people out there who rubber stamp these things, you know, the economists of this world and the large economic bodies. Spending is due to top $1 trillion for the first time this year. This is largely due to the fact that we are handing out huge sums of money on furlough. We're giving money directly to hospitality businesses that we've forced to shut, or that might as well effectively be shut anyway, as we are discovering with the tiers system, which we won't go into too much detail on, other than to say, I completely fail to understand why you can't go to the pub and sit there and have a pint by yourself without a substantial meal, when you're not actually allowed to go to the pub with people outside your household anyway, and you have to sit at a table, and you can't stand up, and it has to be table service. So why does it matter whether you're having a meal or not? The meal thing was to stop people presumably getting drunk and losing their inhibitions and hugging each other, but you're not allowed to go there with other people anyway. So what's going on?
In the defence of that, the last time I went to the pub, I actually went by myself. That sounds really sad. And I had a meal just because, you know, I was here on my own as I moved back to the house recently. And a very, very drunk man, I don't know if he'd had a substantial meal. He needed one. Came over anyway, so and wanted to sit with me. Presumably felt sorry for me sitting all by myself. I was fine. I'm a strong, independent woman. But anyway, that might be the point. No, I don't. I get it. To me, this seems a bit nanny-ish, that whole substantial meal. There's another agenda there, and I think that's presumably what quite a few other people think.
I think it looks almost suspiciously like they make this stuff up as they go along.
Well, there is that as well, yeah. But I do think there's Boris Johnson's obesity drive and agenda, but I don't understand this because we mentioned earlier about the number of people drinking at home. I
don't know. It's beyond me. What I tell you what it means, basically, going back to what we were actually talking about, is that basically the Chancellor has to keep handing out money to pubs because pubs are being hampered by the fact that everybody has to come in and have a meal, and so people aren't going to go to the pub and have a drink because they don't want to have a meal, they're not hungry, they don't want to spend the money on a meal, various other things. So we have to hand out more money to pubs. We've had to hand out lots of money to lots of other people in order to keep them going. Tax receipts will be $771 billion for 2020, which is almost $102 billion lower than was predicted in March at the budget. What you need to remember about the figure in March at the budget is that it was already being held back and we were already doing things by coronavirus and we were already doing things to help people with coronavirus. $280.9 billion increase in spending this year. Now, obviously, if you compare that to the $102 billion less in tax, you can see that there's a bit of a gap there. We're going to get $56.6 billion less in tax than last year. We've got problems, basically. What it means is that at some point we're going to have to try to balance the books. But at the moment, we don't need to try to balance the books because the Bank of England has been printing large sums of money and the government has an effective unlimited overdraft with the Bank of England. And so we're kind of financing it with money that we're just conjuring up. The magic money tree has been in overdrive this year. But that's okay because everybody is shaking their moneymaker at the moment like absolute crazy. And as long as the whole of the rest of the world's doing it, we don't need to worry too much about it. If there is a reckoning to come in some years, it will be in some years. And then we might start to see the return of the A word, the horrible A word, austerity. But let's not
worry. They don't have to worry about that now, do we?
Let's not worry about that now because we don't want to worry about that kind of stuff at the moment. Everything's a bit too miserable anyway.
Yeah, just in sum then, what's the recovery looking like? What letter are we on now? Because I don't think it's a V, to be honest.
We were on a V, and I think the V has been paused. We might be getting a sort of weirdly shaped W.
Okay.
Are we going to see negative growth this quarter? Bank of England thinks so. Are we going to see negative growth in the first quarter of next year? Well, that all depends what happens with this new tiers system and whether it is just locked down by another name, doesn't it? Maybe we're not. Maybe we're going to see things come back up. So we might not see a you know, double dip recession, but we're going to see something that looks a bit like it, even if the numbers don't bear it up. I personally would like to strike an optimistic note And I think that we are going to see some pretty good times in years to come. I think spending has held up remarkably well this year when you consider what's happened. I think people's appetite for doing stuff when lockdown was eased, getting out, and even things like eating out and going to the pub when they were open, or trying to buy from the places that were being innovative. And, you know, look at those pictures before businesses were even allowed to open of people going out and having, you know, takeaway pikes on the seafront and everything like that. Now, ignore the bit where, you know, people were complaining about they weren't socially distancing and da, 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 da. We're talking about the economics of it here. People were eager to get out and suspend. And I think that that is going to continue after this. I think we've got major problems from job losses. But if people do get out and spend, if we do see consumer spending be more robust, remember, we've got lots of job losses, but we've also got people who feel like they've saved lots of money. There, we had a thing last week saying that grandparents were going to spend loads of money on their grandkids this year. We've got people living for the moment. They're saying, right, I might as well enjoy life. I might as well spend some money and have a good time. The surprising number of people who wanted to go on holiday, mm-hmm. overseas, but in this country, you could not find a holiday let in August. Once it was revealed that people would be able to go, there was you couldn't find anywhere apart from a few like really overpriced places, or if you want to go stay in the middle of a city. I think all this bodes well for the future, and it can become a virtuous circle. It feeds into it, and things pick up. So, and then businesses go, right, we'd better rehire some people. So those people have some more money, and then things pick up again. And I think that it could be not just a really short-term thing. I think it could actually last a few years. And I genuinely think that once we get through this, get this vaccine rolling out and everything like that, try to get back to normal, I genuinely think there could be some good times ahead for everybody.
Do you think the OBR then was too pessimistic, too gloomy?
I think potentially it was. I genuinely think potentially the OBR was too pessimistic. I think that there are better grounds for optimism, but it's got to err on the side of caution, hasn't it? Mm. It's been told off so many times before for being too optimistic. I could be completely wrong here. This is just my opinion, but my glass is half full.
But from the outside looking in, if financial issues, I mean, whether we go out and shop, are largely, I think, not down to, but influenced by sentiment, positivity. If I feel good, if I feel like there's bright times ahead, then I might go out and spend more. What is the point of being gloomy? Why do people have to caveat saying, oh, you know, it's just my opinion and I don't really mind. I like hearing you talking well, Simon. It makes me feel good. It makes me feel like, okay, I don't have to be quite so hoardy.
Why be gloomy?
Because
everything is a bit gloomy, isn't it? I mean, but there's no, yeah.
But
I mean,
why is it? What's it such not a being, bad
they're not being deliberately. They're not being deliberately gloomy. The OBR would say it is basically just stating is using its models and its forecasts. You can't just being optimistic for the sake of it and ignoring what's really going on in the world is not really a great tactic. You know, the boosterism of doing that kind of thing. It can be seen through. I mean, in the old sunlit uplands of you know, of argument for Brexit and stuff like that. Nobody bought that. They bought into Brexit for other reasons. They didn't really buy into that. And nobody does still buy into that. This bizarre buccaneering Britain free trading will actually do more business. Argument, it would be better for the economy. Nobody really buys into that. They might buy into the fact that it's a good idea to get out of the EU. So I don't think there's really any point in being overly optimistic for the sake of being overly optimistic. And I can sit here and pontificate and say, well, I think things are going to be much better than actually. But I'm not in the position of having to back that up with pages and pages and pages of cold, hard numbers that are going to be pored over by every, you know, economist and financial journalist in the country, and then I'm going to be held to account on it. I can just go, well, it's just my opinion. I reckon things are going to get better.
Well, I like your opinion because it's more positive. We're going to talk about what else was in there. Not a huge amount, but I guess the one that's got the finance journalists talking was the RPI.
Yes, indeed. So this is something that affects investors and it affects people's pensions as well. And basically, it's not going to phase out this flawed way of measuring inflation. RPI is the old way of measuring inflation. It's not even actually an official statistic anymore, but the ONS still puts it out because it's still used in lots of things. And the government has said that it's going to stop using RPI. RPI tends to be higher than CPI, and it is going to be delayed when it's going to be phased out until 2030, which means that people who have RPI, resale prices index linked bonds, people who have pension payouts linked to RPI, and all these other things are going to continue to get a higher payout for the next 10 years. So it's not going to be phased out as soon as people thought. It does also mean on the flip side that students whose student loan interest is linked to it, and also commuters whose train ticket rises are linked to it, are going to end up having to pay more, which is unfortunate. But it's good news for pensioners and also investors who hold anything that is RPI linked.
All right, then. We'll leave that to one side and we'll get on for our weekly slot called More Bad News for Savers. Yeah, it does seem like we're having it weekly. The darling, the saviour, the port in the storm, that was Marcus, has decided to cut its rates again, just 2 months after it reduced the rate from 1.05 to 0.7%. Now it'll be just 0.5%, and that will come in on December the 11th. I got that email and I thought it was just a reminder about the last cut, so I didn't really think that much of it until I was reading the financial pages and went, oh god, another one. And it is off the back as well, of course, of brutal cuts by NS&I. Simon, why?
I've got a Marcus account, and I must admit, I thought the same thing, Georgie. You're not alone.
Oh, good.
It was, in fact, another cut. And it's from 0.7 to 0.5, which is unfortunate because it was considerably higher than that in the past. And unfortunately, though, savings rates have been absolutely tumbling across the board. This week, we have seen massive cuts from NS&I come in, with rates on easy access accounts cut to as low as 0.01%. A rate which I have previously referred to as being an insult, and I would rather have no interest than 0.01%. My wife got a letter from one of her bank's savings accounts this week, and it covered a 3 month period, and to tell her that she'd earned a penny in interest. Now, I don't know whether the bank pays the full first class postage cost, which I believe is 70p. At the moment, but if it does, it means that the bank spent 70p to send her a statement saying she'd been paid a penny in interest. She said, I'd prefer it if they'd just split the 70p with me and not sent me a statement and put 35p in my account. Marcus did pay as much as 1.5% for the year after it was launched in September 2018. It now fails to beat inflation, which rose to 0.7% last month. This is just the way of the world. And unfortunately, there is very little competition to pay savers decent rates at the moment. But having said that, you might as well move your money to the best possible place for it, because it's better than being paid the worst possible rate. The best possible rate is always better than the worst possible rate. There you go. Financial genius there.
Genius, indeed. Word about NS&I?
They've really let savers down. They've really let savers sit down at a time when they need them, and rates have been absolutely slashed. But NS&I's hands are tied because it is entirely dependent on what the government wants it to do. So really, there was nothing that NS&I could do.
Is that it for savers? Is it mattress time?
It's not mattress time, because you can still earn more than your mattress will pay you. The top easy access rate is 0.6% at the moment, and there's a handful of 0.5% rates. And also, just keeping money under your mattress is not a sensible move, because you might get robbed, and it might be like the Princess and the Pea. It might be really uncomfortable.
That's true.
But I mean, to be more sensible, basically, you could keep your money in cash at home, but that is not a good move. Keeping your money in cash at home. The other option is, do you want to go looking for a better return by investing? But you've got to be comfortable with taking the risk. You've got to be comfortable with the fact that you might also lose some money. If you are cautious, try and aim for a cautious investment that doesn't try to shoot the lights out, but gives you an inflation-beating return don't put all your eggs in one basket, and make sure you've got a rainy day fund held in cash, not under your mattress, before you invest any money.
Indeed. Don't go to the mattress. If people have saved some money, they could use it to go on holiday, Simon. Combination of coronavirus vaccine news, sales on, travel-starved Brits planning to treat themselves to a better foreign holiday next year after missing out this year. Are they barking mad, Simon? Or is now the perfect time to book? So some travel experts reckon it is, and they're predicting that flight prices could soar as demand grows due to the easing of restrictions once a vaccination program is rolled out. Meanwhile, the amount of cut price deals, you might have noticed them, currently available is huge, but is it safe to book now? There are a heck of a lot of if, buts, and maybes in there, Simon. Vaccines, all those sorts of things, if restrictions are eased, if airlines can get back off their knees, all those sorts of things. And I do have to say, very good article. Not saying anything about the article. What I am saying is you've got to wonder who the experts are that are saying that you should book. And actually, the experts are someone who works for a travel firm and someone who works for a travel comparison website, which both of which will earn money from us spending to go abroad. So look, is there vested interest in here, or do they have a valid point?
Never underestimate Britain's desire to go on holiday. Nobody ever lost money doing that, but actually the travel industry is littered with companies that have lost vast sums of money and gone bust, so you can't use that particular aphorism. But never underestimate Britain's desire to go on holiday. Also consider the fact that when Britain does decide to go on holiday and book stuff again, which at the moment it's not booking stuff, because even Britain, after having had its fingers burned repeatedly by booking holidays in 2020 and the government's game of quarantine roulette, has realised that maybe it might want to hold off on booking those trips for a while. So you can book stuff relatively cheaply at the moment, and you can also get some really good perks in terms of the fact that you can cancel and rebook and shift things around, which quite often you can't do with things like flights, or you have to pay through the nose to do it. BA, for example, is basically letting you just cancel or change your flights if you want to. You can get your money back in the form of a voucher, which is pretty good. And when people suddenly start booking again, they're going to discover that there is less capacity. As Mike Gooley, founder of Trailfinders, said, airlines have mothballed whole fleets of aircraft and crew and will take months to swing back into action. The shortfall in seats will give rise to a sharp hike in future airfares. We can hardly blame the airlines taking the opportunity to repair their massive losses. Talk in his own book, of course, but it is true, actually. If you looked end of August time, school holidays in August, even though quarantine roulette was going on, flights were very expensive. Not as expensive as they normally would be in terms of that time of year, but they were pretty expensive. And it was actually not even that they were very expensive. It was almost impossible to get flights to some places because the airlines they'd cut their capacity, amalgamated a load of flights, and they hadn't put more on. So I went away in the last week of August. I got lucky. I went to Portugal. And as regular listeners will know, I booked my flights approximately 3 minutes after it was announced that you could go to Portugal and come back and not quarantine, because me and a certain Mr. Lee Boyce were sat in the office and he was like, you can go to Portugal. And I jumped straight on it. But flights went up massively that evening. I got in there just before, but then flights went up massively that evening. But I had been also trying to go to Greece, but we couldn't go to Greece because we just couldn't get the flights. They just did. It wasn't even necessarily the cost of them, although the cost of the ones that you could find was exorbitant. It was that the flights didn't exist. So what you had was a scenario where if you could go somewhere, accommodation was cheap because hardly anybody was going and there was a massive oversupply of accommodation, but you just couldn't even get there, kind of thing. And I think that there is certainly going to be an element where when people start booking again, the capacity is there, that's there, will swiftly get snapped up. Now, the airlines, I think, will manage to get more capacity. The places to stay will be there. Some of them will have closed down. Some of them maybe will decide not to open, but they will be there. But people might find that it suddenly looks surprisingly expensive. They'll be thinking they're going to get a really good deal and it'll look surprisingly expensive. The solution to that is to book now, but then who knows what's going to happen? You might not be able to go. So make sure anything you do book is cancelable or movable, or you are happy with the fact that you might get your money back in the form of a voucher rather than returned in cash.
Would you? Because they're saying like trips of a lifetime are going to be in the future trips of a lifetime. That's what the predictions are from all the travel experts. And yet you're looking now and you're sort of seeing, you know, trips to Mexico, trips to wherever, Australia, which I don't even think are accepting people at the moment, where people are looking, and they are cheaper now. So would you do it, and would you go big, or would you go a little home. Bit smaller?
Yeah, go big or go home. Go big or stay home. Is that the question? Would I go big or stay home?
What would you do?
I must admit, I usually have some flights booked in my back pocket somewhere, or a holiday plan somewhere in my back pocket that I've got coming up. And this year, and I don't at the moment, right about now, I'd usually be trying to book some flights to go away for a long weekend snowboarding in January, because that's a great time to go to Austria, which I absolutely love at that time of year. Then I'd be thinking about an Easter family ski and snowboard trip. I've done less thinking about it at the moment, I think, than I normally would do. I'm still planning on the Easter one. January looks very unlikely, and I almost booked some flights actually in September for January, and then I didn't because things started to look a bit more like not able to go, and I haven't booked them at the moment. But you know, I've got my fingers crossed for March and beyond. Definitely got my fingers crossed.
I'm tempted.
It would be, now would be a really, if you want to go on holiday next summer, now would probably be a really good time to book some flights that you could move or cancel, and a villa or something like that. That would probably be quite a good idea. Whether I'm organised enough to do it is another matter.
But then they say you get more protection on package holidays, and that's what people are expecting, that they're going to rise in numbers of people booking package holidays, because they've sort of fallen off a little bit, haven't they?
There is a suggestion that people will go back to package holidays because of the greater protection that they get. And there's certainly most of the people who booked package holidays got their money back, whereas others are still fighting airlines for money. So yeah, I think there is an argument for that. I'm not really a package holiday kind of booker. So,
Nor I. Well, let's move on from that. Do let us know if you're going to be booking a holiday and where. But finally, because we like to cover it all on This Is Money, we have a letter from a reader about their windows. We have double glazing at our house, your reader writes, that will need replacing soon, as they're nearly 20 years old. What is the difference between double glazing and triple glazing when it comes to price, and what it actually does? Is it worth the extra outlay? And they don't have a small house, so this could cost a fair amount if there's a big difference. Simon, the answer is?
The answer is an extra sheet of glass. Obviously, double glazed windows have two sheets of glass with a gap in between them. It's usually about 16 millimetres. I'm seeing what Grace has written here in the article. Triple glazing, three sheets of glass, two gaps. This can make them much better at insulating than double glazed windows, and also can make them much better at soundproofing as well. But be careful, because it's not always the case. The most energy efficient type of glass for double and triple glazing is low emissivity, low E glass, according to the Energy Saving Trust. This has a microscopically thin coating of metal oxide on one of the internal glass surfaces. That coating reflects heat back into the home, but still lets the light in from outside. In terms of cost, we spoke to Alaskan Windows, which is a window installer, said customers could be looking at a significant uplift for triple glazing. The extra pane of glass increases the weight of the window, which means the other window components, such as hinges, often need to be upgraded. Whether it's worth the extra cost is subjective, it claims, but it said that in its experience, the nominal annual energy saving that is calculated isn't significant enough to do so. Depends on your property, where you live. Do you live in the milder south, the chillier north? Do you have a north-facing house in a frost pocket kind of thing that means it's very cold? Also, do you live on a busy road? Do you have road noise, train noise? A couple of places I've seen with triple glazing have been overlooking a busy road or with train tracks at the back, and it was remarkably quiet inside. So often people go for triple glazing not just for an energy efficiency reason. If you do decide to go for it, you will probably find that it is considerably more expensive. So it comes down to personal choice.
And how much money you have to spend on it. That's it for now. You can keep up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app. And if you have any comments or questions for the team or anything you'd like them to look into, Simon?
You can email us at editor@thisismoney.co.uk. You can tweet us at thisismoney, or you can come to thisismoney.co.uk/podcast to join in the debate and read the comments and tell us whether you would go big or stay home or buy triple glazing.
Indeed. And if you like our podcast, why not rate us on iTunes? It helps people find us.